called Fair Plaisia. Hello there, Margaret Weaver. Out. Are you there with us?
Hello, Adrian. How are you?
I'm absolutely fine. Do you know that there were so many rumors as to where you might have been for the last hour? And, you know, we had to make a lot of excuses here because, in hindsight, it was our miscalculation, not yours. But you wouldn't believe, we had people over in McDonald's, Clark's, and Roaches in the pubs.
The three pubs,
and then Kelchamah, and we were, but anyway, we were, and then there was a report that the guards pulled you over for speeding. Honest to God, you wouldn't believe
all kinds of rumors, Adrian.
I am delighted to welcome you, Margaret. And on a very serious note, my God, before we even get to your fabulous book on Martin Sheridan, which we didn't know that much about here anyway, you, in addition to, having your degrees, bachelor's in English and history, Master's of Science in Library and Information Studies, and you work at the Mayo Library Service, live in Bohola. But you have spent a lifetime with such, great experience in research and in everything. But to take on your book here, the bestseller in Ireland, to take on this 535 pages, my God, when it came through the door here, you need to have your stirabout in the morning to lift it.
It was a mammoth task, Adrian.
Yeah, and did you?
It was a mammoth task. But, yeah.
I just wanted to ask you though, like when you started, and you have researched everything, and that's what you do, but did you have an idea that it would take years, number one, and that there was so much new information about somebody who was an Olympic star from Ireland there at the turn of the last century?
I didn't realize, Adrian, when I started writing that there would be so information coming on stream. And I had heard of Martin Sheridan. I'm from Charlestown myself, so I married a Bohola man, so I only lived over the road from Martin Sheridan.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing ever was documented on him, and it was only somebody said to me coming up to his 100th anniversary of his death, wouldn't it be nice to do something about him? And I thought, well, I got thinking about it, and I thought, well, I'll start it. But having started it, now it did take on huge proportions.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I felt that this was a man who, Martin Sheridan's story indeed, resonates with so many of his countrymen. A young man from the west of Ireland who immigrated to America in 1897, in the aftermath of the land wars and the famine,
yeah,
with a basic education and very little money, and who, through his own talent and his skills, became a world player on the world stage. He immigrated,
yeah,
Adrian, in, as I said, in 1897,
yeah,
and his first foray into employment was in as a trolley car driver in New,
yeah,
York. And then in 1906, he joined the New York Police Department, and he rose up through the ranks there and was lauded in every aspect of his work. But he really, his athletic career, he started off in 1902. So really, Adrian, he had only 12 years as an athlete and an Olympian to
Incredible.
Achieve all,
yeah,
he did.
And you know, he obviously, it was known, and again, as I say, little was known. Everybody knew that there was this great Irishman, Bohola man, and that, he did extremely well, and that he threw the learned how to throw the discus and whatever. Can you just fill us in a little bit on that? Did he learn that stuff here, or, you know?
I think he had his skills. I think, Adrian, he had his skills honed here in Bohola when he was going to school. I the research says in the book they used to throw then stones, and Martin Sheridan could outplay any of his comrades.
Yeah.
He could outrun them. He could he was gifted as a young fella. When he went to America, he had his brother, Richard, who was another gifted athlete, and he was there in New York. And when Martin Sheridan, he joined the Pastimes Club first,
yeah,
and then he went on to the Irish Amateur Athletic Club, which was his club for the remainder of his life. That's where he honed his talents as well. And in the short space of his life, he went on to win 9 Olympic medals, 5 gold, 3 silver and a bronze. And he took part in more than 12 national championships and more than 30 American metropolitan and regional championships. And when the Olympic Games were being held in Greece in 1906, he so impressed the King of Greece that he had a statue of him erected in his honour.
Wow.
Now, in 1909, there was at that time, when Martin Sheridan was competing, there was a thing called, there was a championship called the All Round. Now, it would be the equivalent to our decathlon today. And he won that competition in 1905, in 1907, and again in 1909. And that would include the 100-yard dash, the running high jump, the running broad jump, the pole vault, the 16-pound hammer throw, the 56-pound weight, and the 120-yard hurdles, and
oh,
half mile walk.
Yeah.
So he was such a strong, he had such stamina, and he was such a strong man that in 1909 in the New York Times, they hailed him as the best all-round champion of the world and the most handsome.
Wow. Now, did he have a family?
No, there was a reference. When I was doing the research, Adrian, there was a reference to something of his wedding plans. Now, whether his fiancée or I don't know what happened, but I could never find any follow-up on that. But it would be very unusual for a man of his caliber and his physique not to have some lady in on the sidelines. But I didn't find anything to that.
Yeah, but between ourselves, okay, Margaret, I want to tell you, if he was the Elvis Presley at the time, what the hell would he be rushing into the marriage scene for anyway?
He was. He certainly was the Elvis Presley of the time, yes.
Let me ask you, though, about the family that he came from. We would have to know that the political turmoil, you know, during his short 16 years in Ireland was brewing, you know, very quickly. Tell us about his uncle, P.J. Sheridan, and his involvement with the Land League in Mayo.
Yes. Martin Sheridan came from a hugely political family. As you rightly said, his uncle, P.J. Sheridan, was a founder member of the Land League. He was involved with Davitt and Parnell. And in fact, when I was doing the research, it was his uncle, P.J. Sheridan, he was instrumental in signing, in swearing Parnell into taking the oath for the IRB.
Yeah.
Now, that was on the eve of the Phoenix Park murders.
Wow.
Martin Sheridan's brother, should I say now first, Joe, was married to Kitty Collins, a sister of Michael Collins. General Michael Collins.
Yes.
His father, Martin, also was involved in politics. His grandmother, and in fact, the house in Bohola, his house here in Bohola, was often raided during the Troubles in the 1921-22.
Yeah.
And it was visited by the military. So he grew up imbued with those politics. And he was a staunch nationalist, you know, when he took part in the London Olympics. And you can see the reports there that I have in the book there. Yeah. Since back, he was the correspondent for the New York Evening. You can see the reports he sent back from London. He was not going to.
Yeah.
Fascinating. He was not going to bow to English law, and he told it as it was, and he kind of until the day he died. I think was his aim. Yeah. To put Ireland on the stage. And in fact, Adrian, he took part in so many games in Celtic Park.
Yes.
He fundraised for Sinn Féin, for a lot of the Irish causes there. And he gave his time and his skills to it.
He gave his time and his skills. And, you know, as you pointed out, one would imagine with all his athletic endeavors and, you know, his efforts on behalf of the nationalist movement in Ireland, you know, that he would barely hang on in the police department. He rose very quickly. Now, I just want to ask you a little bit about the Land League, and was that mostly, I mean, for those of us who grew up in Mayo, we kind of associated the Land League with, you know, our corner of the political spectrum at the time. Was that, where did that start, and what was the, you know, roughly in the capital, what was the Land League and what was its significance in Irish history there?
The Land League was founded. It was founded in 1879, and it was really to protect the tenants. You know,
right.
It was a fair rent, fixity of tenure, and a freedom to operate the land. And it was Michael Davitt really, and Parnell to a certain extent, that was the founders of that, and they employed a tactic. They didn't. Michael Davitt was not a man for violence, so he employed a tactic known as boycotting.
Yep.
So, say for instance that if you were evicted off your land, if any other neighbour came in and rented that land, they were boycotted.
Yes.
They were shunned, and that was the way that they operated, because violence was not in Davitt's book. Neither, I'd say, was it in Parnell's, really, or in P.J. Sheridan's. So the Land League then went on. It was a countrywide movement then. So after the Land League, Parnell and Davitt was imprisoned, the women took over the Land League, and they helped families that had been evicted, looked after them, took them into their homes, and looked after their physical needs.
Yeah. Now, what was Mother England doing at that time? Did they kind of let them have at it, so to speak? Or
I think so. I think Mother England we'll say that bit removed.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see, Mother England looked on from afar. But
right.
I think Mother England had agents that knew very well what was going on, and there was a fact that the boycott word that came into the English language was
from
Moorhall Estate.
Yeah.
They boycotted him because they wouldn't even entertain him in any of the shops and that, so he ended up, you know, having to sell off us all the stuff and all the grain and agricultural produce. So it was one way of dealing with it, you know. But Martin Sheridan was well aware his grandmother attended many of the Land League meetings here in Bohol. I have that in the book, you'll see it there.
Yeah.
All the meetings that was held. And it was just, at the time, I think it was just the way politics were going, and Martin Sheridan was well aware of what was happening.
Yeah.
So I think that's why he was so adamant in his views, and he was such a you know, so much, he had such passion for Ireland and the nationalist cause.
Now, did he ever, you know, you had mentioned there that he was at the London Olympics. Did he ever go back to Ireland from once he came here, or do we?
He did, once, after the London Olympics. He came over to, he came here to visit in the London Olympics were held in 1908, so he came here in September. And he visited, he put on three displays of his sporting skills, one in Ballina, one in Dundalk, and one in Dungarvan. And you'll see there the reports that the Western people had of the Ballina sports. That's the nearest one to us. It was, they were, the sports were thronged. And he was given the highest accolades from the town councils, in Ballina and in Swinford, and also in Drogheda and Dundalk and in Dungarvan. He spent 6 weeks here, Adrian, when he came home. And sadly, that was the only time he did come home.
Now, before we get to his untimely passing, I would say, and really mean this, in that very little and very little research, you know, has been done on Martin Sheridan. One might have imagined that as the winner of 9 Olympic medals, you know, for not only New York, for the United States, that would warrant, you know, much more research. But boy, I tell you, when you got at it, you've really made a tremendous job of this. And you take in a lot of, you know, of other details with respect to what it was like, you know, and it gives a great story of immigration, of coming in after the famine, the, you know, the unsettled, you know, atmosphere, particularly in the west of Ireland. You know, there were some areas of Ireland, and, you know, that none of them were doing great, but they did a hell of a lot better than, you know, areas like the west of Ireland. Was there, in your research, did most of, you know, the, say, the Land League and the political environment there, was that stirred, you know, by anger, by, you know, again, a rising of sorts? You know, you're talking about the say, at that time, leading up to Ireland's independence, what was the, say, take again, the west of Ireland, what was the impetus? Because a lot of times, you know, they say, well, if it wasn't for a few dubs, we wouldn't have, you know, a free state at all. And that sounds very good if you're on the other side of the Shannon. But what was the reality of...
The reality of it was, Adrian, that the west of Ireland, you take the coastline from Donegal down through Sligo, Mayo, Galway, Clare, down to Kerry. It suffered horrendously. And I think the anger and the ire, as you mentioned, was that there was a lot of foodstuff here available to the people, grain, corn, that was being shipped out of the ports to England. And I think that really is, and you know, you speak about Trevelyan's corn. And Trevelyan, of course, was far removed in London. Now, I don't know whether he knew the full extent of the famine or its consequences, but, you know, Christine Keneally, as you know who I'm speaking of now, she had done great work on that, in that area. But there was a lot of anger and frustration and bitterness. And the west of Ireland suffered the most because it was the poorest. And they had what was known as they had what was known as the lumper potatoes, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And it was the lumpers that fed them. And then when they failed, that was it. They had nothing to resort to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was either, it was the boat, the immigration. And at that time, when Martin Sheridan was growing up, there was nothing here for him, you know?
Yeah. Well, there was
no
nothing,
employment.
Yeah, there was nothing there for many, as we know.
Many.
I just wanted to say, though, because you from Bohola and my being from Attymath, you know, we're both about equidistant from the town of Ballina. Ballina was actually considered to be a garrison town, but it doesn't have the same ring to it as other places. Can you just say around that time or perhaps, you know, or, well, of course, we're talking about 50 years later, but the mystery of the very same people who were starving to death, you know, still working, you know, for the landlords, getting, you know, evicted at a whim.
Yes.
It's one of the ironies of it all is, in addition to all of that, Britain was making out like a bandit with the corn and the imports and whatever. When you think of what that atmosphere must have been like, you know, in the West, and we can draw a circle, you know, around our own area.
That must have been
basically intolerable. And would you say that's what led to the boycott?
Oh, definitely. And if you read now in one of my research pieces, I came across where the canon of the parish priest at the time was a Reverend Thomas Judge.
Mm-hmm.
And conditions were so bad here in Bohola that he appealed to the Mansion House in Dublin,
yeah,
to send relief to Bohola in particular, because he was parish preacher, to alleviate some of the suffering of the people. Now, it was horrendous. And in some of the report, in my other previous book, Adrian, in Mother Agnes Murrough Bernard, the founder of the Fox of Woolham Mills,
yeah,
that's documented as well. So you can, you know, if you read that book, you can see where he was a Dr. Farn. He was a dispensary doctor, a GP in Fox. Mm. The poverty and the suffering of the people, it just was horrendous. So to think then that there was a shipload of corn,
yeah,
and grain and probably sock being shipped out to England. I mean, if I was in that position, I'd be very
sure,
cross as well.
And yet again, if you take that town like Ballina, that became, the hub of, you know, survival for those who would come, you know, from our general area there and come to, you know, to get, you know, the stirabout, which was, you know, and the rations. I mean, what kind of irony was that? Here are the people who are sending the grain, you know, to,
yes,
you know, to Britain, and they're getting,
yes,
you know, they're getting the chaff back.
That's what they're getting. Now, if you read that book, read the Mother Agnes book, or even I think it's in, yeah, in Martin Sheridan's book, there was an immigration plan put in place. He was Tuke. He was one of the more benevolent people,
yeah,
English people. He put an immigration plan in place where he gave money to immigrants, mm-hmm, you know, or to pay for their passage to go to, probably a lot of them went to Gros Island, Canada, and
well,
of course,
right,
to America. And
not great success stories.
On those,
yeah. not great success stories there, Margaret, in the sense that, but you know, considering that immigrating at that point, you know, not just from Ireland, but particularly from Ireland, that had to, you know, many would say that was a bit of ethnic cleansing there as well. And, you know, and there's no other way really to look at it because...
No, and you can't gloss, you cannot gloss over that. Right. I think, in fact, I was reading the statistics. I think over, I think it was over 2 million, nearer to maybe right. 2.5 people immigrated.
Yeah. And they...
In the aftermath of the famine.
And they were the lucky ones that even made it, you know. There is so much research, including my own father back in the 1930s, of, you know, put together a lot of oral history. I'm talking about the 1930s. School teachers in particular, and in the west of Ireland, were assigned, or some of them wasn't compulsory, but to, you know, to go around and to gather the stories and the information from the people who were actually affected, the older people who were still around.
That's right. That's the 1937 Folklore Commission.
Folklore Commission. Wow.
That's the Folklore Commission, and it's online actually, Adrian. You can access that. I think it's under Lucas, or even if you went into the National Library, and it's fascinating.
It is,
and it was a great idea to do that because the pupils at the time, you know, wrote of the time and what was happening and their perspective on it, and it makes fascinating. It makes fascinating reading.
Yeah. How helpful will history record that the Catholic Church, how helpful was the Catholic Church during that period of time?
How helpful was the Catholic Church?
You know,
I think some parishes, some, let me put it like this. You know, as I say, doctors differ and patients die, but priests in parishes, each priest, I think, was different, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
The priest here that I have recorded in the book there, he seems to be aware of the problem. The Catholic Church, I suppose, they were maybe governed a little bit by the state. They didn't want to rock the boat, that type of thing. So they were kind of erring on the side of caution, you know.
Yeah, and
now,
I won't
generalize.
Yeah, and without, you know, being ratty about it, they, you know, none of them were starving. And again, that, you know, that's about as far down that road as I want to go, you know. But the truth of the matter was. That, yes, you know, a lot of them, you know, let's say could have done more, but also, Margaret, and I'm taking advantage of your amazing knowledge and, you know, of history in general, but, you know, a lot of stuff could have been resolved or could have been handled better at a local level. So if you remove the church and the priest and the Catholic Church, you weren't left with that much other than the, you know, the political movements that were taking place there at the time. Again, as in, you know, Sheridan's, the Land League. There were some people who perhaps said, listen, this is not, we can't rely on this anymore. We have to do something. And pacifists, you know, were gathering together and saying, listen, we're not looking for trouble here, but this crap has to end. Would you say that was fairly, was that a kind of the acorn that brought you know, the political aspects of those, you know, who were able to not only understand what was happening, but to say, listen, we have to do something if we're going to survive.
Yeah, I think it was, and I think really, and you say that the crux of the matter or the kernel, I think it was when the government decided that they would distribute the land of estates, you know.
Yeah.
And give the land back to the people. I think that really resolved a lot of the, well, we'll say the anger and the bitterness, and they were able to buy
yeah.
back the land. I think that was a huge step.
Let me ask you go ahead.
No, those landed, those estates that were in the hands of the English, I think when the Irish got the chance to buy them back, I think that really resolved think that really, you know, the land was very important to the Irish people. Because I think, you know, if you ever watched that film, and I know you did, The Field with Richard Harris, it is the epitome of Irishness. It really is.
Yeah.
And I think when they landed estates were distributed back, or when they were able to buy back, that I think that resolved a lot of it.
Yeah,
that's my thinking on it.
Yeah. Let me ask you in terms of timing, and I have to say, I was never accused of being a swift reader, so I should have this done by Christmas. I should have get through your book by Christmas, 12 months. I'll write it down to make sure I have it. But you, you cover so much. In addition to, you know, the purpose of the book in the first place is to bring us not only, you know, to the significance and the historical significance of a great athlete and a great Olympic winner, but also, you know, somebody who left and didn't get sidetracked by his amazing success. It seems like he was a powerhouse for Ireland here. He didn't just meld into Irish American when he came here. He pretty much spent his life taking the success that he had and that he was gaining and putting it to positive use in terms of, would you say that a lot of that came from the fact that, you know, he had uncles, he had his grandmother, he had everybody. He learned a lot, let's say, in the 16 years growing up in Ireland to be able to maintain, not just maintain that level of interest, but to actually, you know, turn his fame into not only spreading the word, but he collected, you know, a lot of money from those here who felt that his message, maybe they were hearing for the first time, you know. He did very
yes.
well in that.
Yes, you're right. And he, Martin Sheridan, as you very rightly say, apart from his fantastic skills and his prowess on the athletic field, he was a really caring person. And it's in the book there, and you'll see it, Adrian. He was one of the first men to advocate the induction of a black man into his as they called it, his beloved club, the Irish Amateur Athletic Club, John B. Taylor, John Baxter Taylor. And John Baxter Taylor was a runner, and he was like Martin Sheridan, he died very young. But when I came across that, I said to myself, here is a man that not only has, you know, proven himself on the world stage, but is such a caring man. And believe it or not, they were one of the first clubs to have Jews running in it.
Right.
Albal Kiviat,
yes.
He was one of the track and field, the same as Martin Sheridan. He was one of the Olympic medalists. And he, you know, it says a lot. It says a lot for the man,
yeah.
for Martin Sheridan.
Absolutely.
And if you look
yeah.
at that, you know, that was probably not looked on very favourably, but he stood up for them, and he he stood his ground. Martin Sheridan was one of the person that founded the Police Benevolent Fund, you know, for widows and families that would have been
absolutely. There is so much information in this book and historical facts, extremely well researched. But it also, you have a great flow in it, and you know, even the way I read books, you know, I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, but I do have, you know, kind of go back and forth in trying to pick up the story. But you have such, you know, a great number of facts with respect to this. It's a tremendous book, a tremendous read. And would you ever tell us how we go about getting it?
Well, just to mention that, I will tell you, Adrian, how you'll go about getting it. But just to tell you that I did want to bring in the fact that it covered the darker side of the Olympics, that it wasn't all sunshine. I just covered the drugs, the racial prejudice, the politics, gender, sponsorship and advertising, and the evolution of the Games from the Cooper team to the present day. And I thought that was important to include that.
Absolutely.
And to answer your question, it's available. There's a link there that I have. It's available on www.mayobooks.ie.
www.mayobooks.ie. It's terrific. And I'll tell you now, all of this, of our conversation so far, you know, I have enjoyed it and I've learned a lot more. But, you know yourself that, you know, your own is your own. And if I were to get off without mentioning my own family, the O'Dwyers of Bohola, my life.
Yes, of course. That would be very remiss of you.
I would be back. I would be back in Bohola using your bicycle when that, you know, when you were lost there today. That's where I would be, and lucky if I got away with that.
That's where you would be.
But that does bring us to, you know, the great historic, you know, parish of Bohola in County Mayo. A place, you know, one would say kind of off the beaten track. And if you were to, again, of course, we had my uncle, my mother's brother, William O'Dwyer, who became mayor of New York and ambassador to Mexico.
That's
you
right.
had Paul O'Dwyer, who became a civil rights leader, a great lawyer, but in addition to being a great supporter for, you know, the underdog.
All the causes for the North, and yes, of course.
Yeah.
And he was a really good man and did so much good work. And right. Just as you mentioned your uncle there, your Bill O'Dwyer, in the book, he was very, very friendly with Andrew Sheridan.
He definitely was. You know, and Paul too. And Andrew Sheridan was no slouch either. I'll tell you, he became a very, very, you know, a significant powerhouse.
A prolific man, he certainly did.
Yeah, yeah. And
so you have a lot of, and I have it in the book there. It's in the book there, Adrian, where Bill O'Dwyer, as we call him here in Bowling Bill, said that the highlight of his Sunday was going out to Celtic Park to see Martin Sheridan take part in all the games.
Absolutely.
So there's a big connection there.
Yeah. There are some, and this is becoming very parochial on my part anyway. What you didn't say was that he was throwing the horseshoes at home, but one would wonder, you know, at the time, I mean, firing stones and everything. But I wonder first of all, were there any horseshoes around to be throwing? But even in my day, you would have that game of, you know, putting a stake in the ground, getting a horseshoe, you know, and firing it to see if you could you know, lasso this,
yes,
this little
whoever
thing.
Would fire it the furthest.
Yeah,
yes?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure. And I'm sure. Here in Bohola, there was the royal, the constabulary, the barracks was stationed.
Yeah.
They were stationed here in Bohola, and I have come across it that some of the soldiers, some of the military that were stationed here, they used to come out on a Sunday afternoon and play games. And Martin Sheridan was one of the people that was mentioned was to the fore.
Really?
In his athletic skills at that
yeah.
time. So you know, there was an omen. He was going to go places. That man.
Yeah, it was. I was not actually familiar with that wicked disease, which was known as the Spanish flu. You know, that came in and cut short, you know,
yes.
Martin
yes.
Sheridan's life, and obviously, and a lot of others too. You know, again, as one of the other aspects, you cover all of that. That was kind of a freaky thing, considering of all the diseases that were going at the, you know, that at the time hadn't been arrested. The Spanish flu, that was, excuse the pun, but that was
no,
the killer.
No, I came across something. Yes, I came. You know, you would imagine, Adrian, for a man of his physique and his stamina,
right.
that a flu, you know, wasn't going to take him. But I did come across when I was doing the research that a lot of the soldiers brought back that Spanish flu from the front, you know?
Yes.
And maybe that was part of it. I don't know. But for a man of his stamina
oh
and
God.
His physique and his resilience, yeah.
Right.
It was such a tragedy that he died so young.
Yeah. Now, Was he sick for long? Did this come in? Was this a...
He was only sick, I think, for a few days.
Wow.
He worked right up until the end, and he was admitted into St. Vincent's Hospital in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And he died tragically on I think the eve of his 37th birthday.
Lord save us, yeah. Now you have a there across from the chapel in Bohola there. There is a very fitting monument, you know, to Martin Sheridan. And I'm sure that there are, you know, that it stirs up a lot of, memories and fond memories of somebody, again, very early in his career, you know, at the turn of that century, leaving Bohola and making his mark. It's a great, you know, yes. And then you mentioned Michael Davitt over the road, you know, too.
Yes.
A lot of great history there. And thank you very much for doing that. Can you rattle off some of the other books that you've done? I know you've done a great one on the Foxford Woolen Mills
I've done one on Agnes Murrow Bernard. She was the founder of the Foxford Woolen Mills. She founded that in 1892, Sister of Charity. And
yeah.
As covering that, it's a social history as well. I've kind of given a background to the time that she founded. The famine comes in there, the Land League, the founding
right.
of the land commission, all that type of thing. Foxford Woolen Mills was founded. She founded them to give employment to the
yeah.
to the people because the poverty was just dire around that area. I'm very proud of that book. I've also done it's published. It's online. It was mainly publishing. It's the libraries in Mayo, the censorship and all that type of thing. And it covers the
yeah.
Protestant librarian who worked in Castlebar and who fell foul of the law of the church.
Yeah.
She was a Dunbar, and she ended up losing her job and going back to the military archives in Rathmines. And it just
wow.
covers all the, as you said there, the church, the government, the whole lot. And it was the politics of the time.
Margaret, not just on this book, and of course, the book is Martin Sheridan, Mayo's Famous Son, and it is by our guest, Margaret Molloy, and it covers Martin Sheridan, 1881 to 1980. It is a tremendous read. And as I say, I will be celebrating Christmas 12 months when I finish this book. You know, I will, you know, I'd be very proud of myself. But in the meantime, I have only Sheridan here, and she, you know, takes out some stuff that I can't wait a year for. 535 pages, and that's before you get the appendix, it's great.
Adrian, can I just say, I know that you're tight for time, can I just say that I hope to be in New York in March promoting the book.
Fabulous. That is great.
And
yeah.
Yes. And I hope to do promotion on it with some slides and photographs and maybe a general talk or panel discussions, and I'm looking forward to that.
Right, and it's good that you bring it up now, because I do know that this is very interesting, and before, you know, plans for, you know, next St. Patrick's season, we need to spread the word on that one. I can, you know, think of a few places that you may be able to, you know, get a head start on there. But you're, again, the Mayo Library in Ballina, one is indeed that we're very proud of as well. And you're, you know, no stranger to, you know, the publisher field in national and local magazines and newspapers, including, oh my God, Ireland's Own is still around. And Ireland's Eye, the Irish Catholic, the Western People, the Mayo News, the Connacht Telegraph. Again, that and all of your books. And you say the
yes.
best way to get information, not just on Martin Sheridan book, but on all of your works and indeed your collaborations, would be to... Give us that website again.
www.mayobooks.ie.
And if and just to round us off, I have to again, you know, remind our listeners, you know, because I this is a kind of a sneaky way to get a plug in for my own home parish of Battery Mass, the Irish Hunger Memorial at Battery Park City. You know, commemorating the those not only who died in the Irish famine, but to bring world attention to the Irish famine. That's a great place to visit, and as you know yourself, the Lord works in mysterious ways, and down in Battery Park City in New York City, there you have the ruins of not only the famine house, but a recreation of the famine field from Addy Mass and County Mayo. Margaret,
yes.
It's been a pleasure. It really has.
Lovely to talk to you, Adrian, and thank you very much for having me on your show.
We had to line up to get you. I think a lot of people would say, we were doing fine, actually, until you got on the Late Late Show in Ireland, and then we had to send the dogs out, you know, sussing around, sussing around, and say, where did you go? Good luck to you. It's a fabulous book.
Lovely, Adrian.
And it is a great
contribution.
Thank you very much. Okay. God bless.